Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi there.
Can you hear me okay?
I can.
How are you?
I'm good. Really good. I've made lots of progress on some of my writing, so.
Are you writing another novel?
I'm working on the second one in the science fiction saga, right? So then if we get with Marco, we'll get finished this year, and
Oh great,
will be the second one early next year or mid next year or something.
Great, that's so exciting.
It is exciting. It is very exciting.
Yeah. Hold on just a second, I'm doing something. I'm very excited about this chapter. I mean, this book that we're reading. I did a little research. I wanted to share with you guys. I hope it makes sense. Because I'm reading this, Agnes.
It always makes sense what you tell us. So.
Oh, good. I'm struggling to make sense for myself. If it makes sense to someone else, I'm delighted. Especially now, since so many things are falling apart. It just seems to be, that's the nature of things, right? Yeah. Except I haven't seen anything fall apart on this scale before.
Yeah, when things fell apart, is it?
So I suppose our friend Marco is on his way.
I guess, he usually is here, so. And he didn't say anything about not coming, so.
Oh, I got a chance to look at our Sunday meetup around the Light of
I haven't listened to it all the way through, but about half. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, me too. I learned a lot.
Yeah. It was really interesting to go back over the exercise a couple of years on too, especially given all the reading I've done in Aurobindo since, you know, so.
You're doing Savitri and someone's doing the yoga, synthesis of yoga?
We do that later today.
Oh, okay.
We do it the same day we do the Milton. And then with Matteo and this fellow, I don't know if you know him, Vishnu, that Matteo knows. Anyway, we've been doing The Secret of the Veda and Hymns to the Mystic Fire. So I'm in the middle of like four Aurobindo things.
This is amazing. What an amazing development. And I believe there's something else happening too. There's a relationship between Milton and Aurobindo.
Yes.
I read The Future of Poetry, Aurobindo, and I was amazed how much he knew about Whitman. And yes. He knew Whitman, he knew Melville, he knew Milton and Shakespeare so well. Hello, Marco.
Hi.
So I really feel he's doing a kind of meta-poetics.
Exactly. And Milton's kind of present in Savitri, but in a very kind of shadowy way, you know?
But it's an epic.
It echoes, it resonates, there are resonances there, but there are no specific, you know, well, maybe there are a few, but.
That's one of my favorite words, of course, is resonance. But I'm thinking of morphic resonance in that Sheldrakean kind of way, you know, he was always talking about causative form, what causes a form of something, and his hypothesis is that it can't be something physical, that it's something in the in-between that's more subtle that creates the shape, or is a template for the shape. And once it's manifested, of course, it can have all kinds of relational changes that can occur to it. But I did a workshop with him and his wife, Jill Peirce, and she taught overtone singing, which is a Tibetan chant form.
Yeah.
And he was teaching morphogenetic fields, in biology, and which of course I knew nothing about. No one knew anything about Sheldrake. He wasn't famous yet. I don't even think that famous book came out yet about causative formation. But anyway, I think there's something that happens if you read enough literature or you listen to enough music, you really start to, oh, that's where that comes from. You know, and it's such a pleasure because you hear like a passage from a, you know, an obscure chamber work or something like that. And you'll say, oh, now I know where Beethoven got that theme from. You know, he got it from something in Haydn, you know. You don't know how you know that, but you do. It's kind of a kind of resonance that happens in, you know, these artworks that take on a particular shape, a size and everything. But but it's a grand sort of morphogenetic resonant field. And I'm feeling this very much so as I read Milton and give our attention to the voice as we've been doing, because I've listened to the last two episodes of the Milton that we've been reading together. And I wanted to offer us a little vocal warm up before we start, because I really think it's very fascinating to watch the sort of the evolution of our group read from the beginning. How long ago was it? 6 months ago?
We're getting better.
We are getting better. There is progress in the world. I hope Marco agrees with that. Are you there, Marco? I don't see your head.
I'm here.
Oh, you are.
Hello. Okay. Great. Love your shirt, John.
Oh, thank you. This
yeah,
is
I
my.
I was just thinking that too. Yeah.
I worked once with a bipolar personality. He was designated bipolar, and he said, "Oh, you're bipolar too." And I said, "I am. How do you know that?" And he says, "Look at that shirt." He says, "Look at the blue and the orange and the stripes, and you know, and they're all." And I went, "Oh, okay." Talking about morphogenetic fields, he was able to tap into a kind of synesthesia, he was a very gifted artist too. But anyway, once again, I think this is the mystery of rhythm, how we wear things and colors and shapes and sizes and clashes and blends. And you can hear this in the voice. You can see it in a painting. You can look at a painting and you can hear a poem. You can read a poem and you can feel how the poet and the visual artist were sort of colluding with one another to produce the kind of school. I'm thinking especially of like the New York poets, where you have someone like, I can't remember his name, very famous, you know, like the Ashbery and Schuyler and O'Hara. They were all knew Rauschenberg and, you know, they knew all of the big famous painters at that time. So they're all hanging out and smoking dope and drinking, and Warhol was a part of that too. And they were all doing recitals and poetry recitals, and they're also painting and visiting each other's studios. And I knew some of those people actually. I was once given a small stipend by the Rauschenberg Foundation. Grateful for that many years ago, but because I knew his assistant. Anyway, I'm just sharing all this with you and sort of blabbing away, but I think there's something communal and collaborative happening in our readings and moving from Savitri and Milton and Whitman and who knows who else we might explore, and using the voice to sort of vibrate one another's, you know, those subtle fields that we all share. So I'm zooming today.
Well, I wanted to say, you know, to your example of hearing like snatches of a theme or a motif or a kind of sound, you know, or a meaning in one person's work, one composer's work, for example, and then finding it resonant somewhere else. I think part of what's going on there is that art in general is a kind of conversation, and it's one that happens across the ages. It's one that happens across vast periods of time, but also happens in the microsphere and in particular locales in the scenes of, say, like New York City in the 1950s. and all those painters and poets getting to know each other and riffing off of each other's works and stealing things here and sort of recombining things there. And I think that part of, and you see it in Milton too, when he addresses himself to the epic poets, to Virgil and Ovid and Homer. And I hear a poet here who's putting himself in a conversation with those great epic poets, in addition to all the other allusions and all the other resonances that he's also perhaps consciously, perhaps unconsciously, but I think in many cases with great artists, consciously and unconsciously both, but there's a strong conscious element because they've studied the material. So they know who they're responding to, they know what they're doing, they know when they're playing with a theme that somebody else has played with and sort of doing their take on it. And they may or may not, they may be coy about that, you know, or they may be upfront. And in some places here in the text, Milton is completely upfront about what he's doing. And he's even making claims for his own preeminence or from the preeminence of this work in relation to and in comparison with those other, you know, great works. First of all, because of the theme, he says that this theme is more worthy in some sense of the epic, because it doesn't just have to do with these kind of mythological heroics and, you know, these kind of external acts of violence, but it has to do with this, the human struggle, and our mortality, and our relationship with the infinite and the immortal and the absolute. And so, I have not this time, I think we left off like in the middle of things last time, and I spent a little bit of time with the text,
yeah, trying to figure out
refreshing my memory, but I'm otherwise coming to this very fresh, and I went for a run this morning and I took a shower and I took a cold shower to get ready.
You know, they say that's great for the vagus, the cold water therapy. I take a cold bath every day, sometimes twice a day.
I think of you when I do. Yeah. I definitely don't do it every day.
But you do feel a difference, right?
Oh yeah, it's wonderful.
Can I share with you guys? This is something from Angus Fletcher. Can you see this? It's he's calling the struck. He's looking at the architecture of the book of okay. of the poem. He likens it to a Baroque sort of palace. So you see like the wings of the palace and then you see the center here.
Yeah.
And he says there's books 1, 2, and 3 are in one wing. And I think it's books 10, 11, 12 are in the other wing. And then in the center, you have books 5, 6, 7, 8. And in the corridors here, you have book, I think it's book 9. And book 4. He thinks these books connect the wings with the major central Baroque palace. I think this is fun to think about, and I'm just going to quote him. If you have this visual, maybe you could follow his idea here, his model. The two wings and the central section hold a distant report of vastly remote action, as in the opening books. He says, books 4 and 9 provide the main scenes of foregrounded action, since they displayed the immediate conditions of the fall. And there are overlappings between the books and between architectonic sections, as there would be in a Baroque palace, where certain good pieces of furniture are too much for one room and spill out into the adjacent spaces. Yet something like a Baroque balanced structure is apparent for the whole poem. By the same token, the Baroque flowers into dissymmetry, as we know from the spiral forms of Bernini and Borromini. These twists belong to the unbalancing of a deeply classical, underneath it all, balanced style and format. Then that may be a little too elaborate what he was saying to follow, but because I had to read this passage several times to get it. But I think that he's talking about the importance of models, such as the one he just offers. Talking about the static containment of Milton with all the stories that he tells of all of these different things. But there's something that's constantly dynamic and moving. There's something that has to stay still for us to manage the chaos. He goes on to say, I like to think of Paradise Lost as a poem in which almost nothing happens. Unlike Aristotle's ideal epic, Paradise Lost does not give us the mimesis of an action. It imitates the processing of information. This mimesis includes the drama of disinformation with the fall. Yet in some obvious sense, things must happen in this, as in the other epics. I answer, the happening is a learning. My framework question then is, where does this learning happen? So I think that's a very suggestive. And going back to our opening riffing on the whole idea of morphogenetic fields and causative formation, and how, like Sheldrake, his theory is that form doesn't happen within the form, but is sort of beyond, something beyond the form that creates a template for that form, which is a very old kind of Goethean way of thinking about causative formation and morphogenetic fields. But I think this is a fun thing to think about as we're moving into the end of the poem. I think we have two more books after this.
Mm-hmm. Three, I think.
Now, and only now, could I make sense of what Fletcher is talking about. If I had read that before I read this poem, I think actually I did. And it made no sense to me whatsoever. But now that I'm almost completing it, and this is the second or third time I've read this poem, I'm starting to say, oh yeah, I get it. There is something like an invisible architecture, which is holding together in a kind of telepathic resonance, holding it together. Just as each of our personalities is held together telepathically with the personalities that we know in our environment, but also the multiple personalities within us, which are necessary for us to move from context to context to context. So I hope that resonates with somebody. I feel it would be exciting for me to even think about now. Oh yeah, it is like a Baroque palace moving from corridor to a large conference room back to a bedroom somewhere, and how somehow there's lots of maids and butlers and merchants running between the rooms to help service or to help take care of all these, besotted aristocrats, you know. And I think this is sort of like what's happening in between heaven and hell and earth, how all these messengers are, presenting something of use and possible peril to Adam and Eve. I think it's just a very helpful way of deepening my own appreciation for the incredible artistry of this poet, which is almost like, just when you think you get it, oh yeah, I think I got it. Then you realize, oh, there's a door over there. I wonder what's going on. Then you open it up and go, oh my God, there's another gallery here I didn't even know about. Mm.
It's interesting that he says nothing happens, because strictly speaking, this is before anything happens. This is all prehistorical. And it's really meta to the historical in a way. And I think it's really a psychological poem more than it is a drama or a tragedy, like in like the Shakespearean sense, where you have people that are recognizable characters who, have arcs to their story, and those arcs interact in various ways and produce like the whole thing. But that's not what's happening here. All this is happening in a imaginal space. This is all in an imaginal kind of liminal space that reflects upon the human condition, like reflects upon what it means to be alive as a human character, but does so from another vantage point. It doesn't do so from the same plane. And I think that, this idea of a morphic resonance kind of shape to things is extremely true. I think as a poet, I know that there's some invisible shape to the poem before the poem exists in language that I have access to and can inhabit and utter and repeat. It has a shape to it. And even when I'm writing, I don't know if this is universal or not, but it's not arbitrary at all what words, it could be a playful thing, but in some real sense, it's conforming to, it's trying to find that invisible shape. And what I think is so spectacular about this book and why it's such an achievement, which I wouldn't have known without entering into it, is that whatever is happening in the individual cantos, they're also happening within this architecture that is kind of like pre-existent. It's like the end is already imagined in the beginning. We're not like discovering something as it opens up into like potential. Like I think that this is in a way pre-planned and pre-designed. And maybe not by Milton. That's the interesting thing. But Milton having the access, you know, to perceive or to resonate with that form, and then become the channel to bring the content, you know, all that furniture and all the specifics of the language, right, into manifestation, and then that makes it available to the rest of the tribe and the species, and now we can enter into that Baroque, you know, structure and look around and find different things, because it's so elaborate and it's so huge and ornate that it's practically endless, like all what we can discover in this structure. But it is a particular structure, and one could imagine other kinds of structures. Like I'm imagining a galactic structure, like with spiral arms and a massive black hole, a supermassive black hole at the center of it. And what would that look like as a poem? I'm trying to find out. Like, that's what I'm resonating with. I'm curious about the book 4 and book 9, because those are both in the lower parts of this. And we did book 4 and we're in the middle of book 9. So I wonder what the difference is. We can notice, I mean, there's a different place, like we're in Eden, right, compared to heaven or hell or in between. But what can we notice that's particular or different about, you know, these zones? And why are these zones like important to the overall architecture is something I might be interested in exploring.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant, Marco, and thank you for that. And also, Jeffrey, are we resonating? Is anything resonating for you here? I haven't heard from you.
I love what you're saying, both of you. I'm just thinking that maybe in a way, all writing has these two sides to it. It has this overview, not static, but given element, and then it has the unfolding story part, right? And Milton has given all his emphasis to the top part. There is a little bit of unfolding story inside the cantos, right? Inside the one where we have the Adam and Eve with Satan and the tree of knowledge and all that, we have an unfolding story going on in there, but it is within this larger framework, which is given, right?
And we know the ending already. Like we know it going in, so there's no dramatic reveal of something.
But I mean, Shakespeare, it's more this unfolding story. And, you know, we know the ending's there too. But it's still, the emphasis is not on, because it's not, the ending isn't given in the beginning. It you have to get there through the story, right? Mm. In this case, it's given in the beginning.
I think you're right. Milton didn't come up with this story. Shakespeare almost never had anything original plot in his life. These were all pre-given and all widely distributed and well-known. So the audience was not being introduced in Hamlet to a new play. There, Thomas Kidd had written a version of Hamlet before. And I think Shakespeare wrote several versions of Hamlet. So these are the kind of nightmares the Shakespearean editors have, trying to figure out which edition is based upon the theater performance or some previous editors, screwing up the organization of the scenes. So I think with Milton, this is definitely, it is an epic. And I think there's something about these epics like Aeneid and Ovid, they're about foundations of a culture. The mythopoetics of an entire culture are organized. And that's why I think that, in a strange kind of way, I felt when I was asked by Suma about the Aurobindo, the Life Divine, I approached it like an epic. And it had that kind of oceanic power to it with the ebb and the flow of the words. Although I recognize its philosophy, to me there's once again a huge overlap between philosophy and poetry for me. But before I go off on a tangent, I just wanted to suggest to you guys an exercise for our voices, just to warm us up before we decide how we want to go about reading this. And because I'm also interested in the voice and the invisible architecture of the voice and how our voices are, we each have one, we can do with it as we will, just as we have our brain, we can use our brains in very different ways. But I think there's some overlaps in our sensoriums and how they're arranged and the influences that we have upon one another and what we receive from one another. Because the voice is that mirror mystery where it's inside and it's outside at the same time. I can look at my own voice inside of myself, but I also, you guys can register it as outside of yourselves, but there's also something in between our voices, which is neither inside nor outside, but a little of both. So I just wanted to play around with that and do a little bit of vocalizing, which I think I got this from Jill Peirce, but I don't remember exactly where I got it from, but it comes originally. She got it from Tibetan Vajrayana practice. But I'm not going to go through the whole sequence. There's actually six sounds, and they're all arranged in from the root center to the crown. But I just wanted to play with two tones, one in the belly and one in the throat, okay? Just so we can get a sense of where our voices could come from as we read this text or recite this text. So are you guys with me?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So are you relaxed? Do you feel your feet on the ground and you're in a somewhat stable posture? It's more effective than if you're crumpled up and crooked. Yeah, so we have a sense of our diaphragm and our belly and our chest and our throat, and we have our third eye and our crown sort of in alignment. So if we just play around with, you could even put your hand on your belly button and vibrate with a sound, and that sound is vroom. So it's V-R-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U-U- Take a deep breath all the way in. You're making that V sound, the VR sound. Can you feel your belly vibrating, the viscera?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Let's do it two or three more times. all the way in.
Feel it kind of further up. It doesn't seem to be reaching down my belly.
Yeah,
that's feedback. That's biofeedback. So if your intention, if you put your hand on your belly and your intention is to breathe into your hand, enter that space between behind the hand or in front of the hand, the belly button and back to the spine. If that's your intention, you can send the sound to that and gently. And it may be more open than not, depending on the time of the day or what you've had to eat earlier. Your relaxation or tension, but this is a biofeedback process, actually. So shall we do it one more time, see what happens before we move on to the throat? Just enjoy it. One more time.
Getting down there anyway.
Did you get it? Did you get something down there?
Yeah.
Okay. You could do this for an hour. And you can find opening up all kinds of rooms, mansions and rooms, and many voices. Now, I'm moving us, inviting us just to go with the center and the voice, the throat center, and use the, it's a U sound. So it sounds like this. I slipped into an overtone, which I didn't mean to do, but it just sort of spontaneously.
That's a long breath, Johnny. I can't do that long.
Well, it's from doing all of that Shakespeare. Why do you think I have to give up smoking? You can't smoke and do Shakespeare or sing opera. But I think there's a, if you can just feel that you and vibrating in your voice box there, your larynx, you may feel a split happen between the head and the chest. Anyway, just play around with it. Maybe we'll do it two or three times. Is that okay with you, Marco?
Yeah.
Okay. Take a deep breath in. One more time. And just relax. Relax, 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 and relax some more. And you can relax all the way down to the tip of your toes to the top of your head. So our vagus nerves are all attuned to one another. And I think it's a very wonderful thing to allow your voice to touch the other person's sensorium, so that we are in a way giving each other a massage with our voice.
I agree. Even I'm a bit surprised that it works online, but it did.
This is one of the great experiments, I think, in this area of moving from the analog to the digital and back to the analog. How can we create these healthy relationships between the digital, which is the platform upon which we're moving here, and these analogical kind of practices? I think it's a very fertile field of exploration here. But then I think we have to sort of move through the flat screen and through the speakers into our subtle and very subtle bodies. When in a way we're re-enchanting the flat screen or enchanting it for the first time.
I love that.
I'm ready to rock and roll with this text whenever you guys are ready. So
I need help with the text. I'm a bit lost, actually. I was just thinking about it. I'm not quite sure where I am or where we're going or whatever.
Marco, have you kept track of our, I think we're about halfway through this ninth book, aren't we?
Yeah, we got a little more than halfway through. And I think we just started into the temptation where Satan as serpent approaches Eve and engages her in conversation and ultimately dupes her into eating of the fruit. I don't remember whether we got through that completely and had gotten to the part where she then returns to Adam and reports on what she's learned.
Oh, yeah. I think that's just what she was getting ready to do, wasn't she? Oh, yeah. I remember we got here.
Got into that. But my markups only go up to, I don't know, but there's no break in the text, so it's hard to figure out exactly. And I don't have line numbers, so.
I would suggest that we take a step back and start perhaps at the point where Satan and Adam and Eve begin their dialogue. We could redo that.
Okay.
And then take it all the way to the end. And because if we were to start, I think, where we left off, we probably wouldn't have too much reading. We'd end pretty
okay.
soon.
So that's manageable then. We could get through the whole thing today.
Right.
So tell me where that is, because I even finding that is not easy.
Let's see.
Wonder not, sovereign mistress. Maybe that's going back too far. So spake the enemy of mankind. O guile of hate, of envy, of revenge. What beautiful language this is. Where do we begin? Okay, Adam and Eve have just finished talking. Eve is...
So what about lead then said Eve? Is that possible?
Okay, good. That's where she's telling Satan to lead, to take the lead, right? I know where that is. Okay. Lead then, said Eve. He leading swiftly rolled in tangles and made intricate seem straight to mischief swift.
Yeah.
Okay. Shall I just continue reading and then you get... Who am I reading here? Am I reading Eve? This is Eve. Okay.
Okay, go for it.
And then this is, I think, the narrator describing the movement as Satan escorts Eve to the...
So do you want me to pick up the narrator and you read Eve?
Yeah, if you want to, that would be great. Okay, lead then,
said Eve. He, leading swiftly, rolled in tangles and made intricate seem straight to mischief swift. Hope elevates and joy brightens his crest as when a wandering fire, compact of unctuous vapor, which the night condenses and the cold environs round, kindled through agitation to a flame, which oft, they say, some evil spirit attends. hovering and blazing with delusive light, misleads the amazed night wanderer from his way to bogs and mires, and oft through pond or pool, there swallowed up and lost from succor far. So glistered the dire snake, and into fraud led Eve, our credulous mother, to the tree of prohibition, root of all our woe, which when she saw thus to her guide, she spake.
Serpent, we might have spared our coming hither, fruitless to me, though fruit be here to excess, the credit of whose virtue rest with thee, wondrous indeed, if cause of such effects. But of this tree we may not taste nor touch. God so commanded, and left that command sole daughter of his voice. The rest we live, law to ourselves. Our reason is our law.
To whom the tempter guilefully replied,
indeed, hath God then said that of the fruit of all these garden trees ye shall not eat? Yet lords declared of all in earth or air?
To whom thus Eve, yet sinless?
Of the fruit of each tree in the garden we may eat, but of the fruit of this fair tree amidst the garden, God hath said, ye shall not eat thereof, nor shall ye touch it, lest ye die.
She scarce had said, though brief, when now more bold the tempter, but with show of zeal and love to man, and indignation at his wrong, new part puts on, and as to passion moved, fluctuates disturbed, yet comely, and in act rays as of some great matter to begin. As when of old some orator renowned in Athens or free Rome, where eloquence flourished, since mute to some great cause addressed, stood in himself collected, while each part, motion, each act, one audience ere the tongue, sometimes in height began as no delay a preface brooking, through his zeal of right, so standing, moving, or to height upgrown, the tempter all impassioned thus began.
Oh, sacred, wise, and wisdom-giving plant, mother of science, now I feel thy power within me clear, not only to discern things in their causes, but to trace the ways of highest agents, deemed however wise. Queen of this universe, do not believe those rigid threats of death. Ye shall not die. How should ye? By the fruit? It gives you life to knowledge. By the threatener? Look on me, me who have touched and tasted, yet both live, and life more perfect have attained than fate meant me, by venturing higher than my lot. Shall that be shut to man, which to the beast is open? Or will God incense his ire for such a petty trespass, and not praise, rather, your dauntless virtue, whom the pain of death denounced, whatever thing death be, deterred not from achieving what might lead to happier life, knowledge of good and evil? Of good, how just! Of evil, if what is evil be real, why not known, since easier shunned? God therefore cannot hurt ye and be just. Not just, not God. Not feared then, nor obeyed. Your fear itself of death removes the fear. Why then was this forbid? Why but to awe? Why but to keep ye low and ignorant, his worshippers? He knows that in the day ye eat thereof, your eyes that seem so clear, yet are but dim, shall perfectly be then opened and cleared, and ye shall be as gods, knowing both good and evil as they know, that ye should be as gods, since I, as man, internal man, is but proportion meet. I of brute human, ye of human gods, so ye shall die, perhaps, putting off human to put on gods, death to be wished, though threatened, which no worse than this can bring. And what are gods that man may not become as they, participating godlike food? The gods are first, and that advantage use on our belief, that all from them proceeds. I question it, for this fair earth I see, warmed by the sun, producing every kind, them nothing. If they all things who enclosed knowledge of good and evil in this tree, that whoso eats thereof forthwith attains wisdom without their leave? And wherein lies the offense that man should thus attain to know? What can your knowledge hurt him or this tree impart against his will if all be his? Or is it envy, and can envy dwell in heavenly breasts? These and many more causes import your need of this fair fruit. Goddess humane, reach them and freely taste.
He ended, and his words, replete with guile, into her heart too easy entrance won. Fixed on the fruit she gazed, which to behold might tempt alone, and in her ears the sound yet rung of his persuasive words, imprend with reason to her seeming and with truth. Meanwhile, the hour of noon drew on, and waked an eager appetite, raised by the smell so savory of that fruit, which, with desire, inclinable now grown to touch or taste, solicited her longing eye. Yet first pausing a while, thus to herself she mused.
Great are thy virtues, doubtless best of fruits, though kept from man and worthy to be admired, whose taste, too long forborne, at first to say, gave elocution to the mute, and taught the tongue not made for speech to speak thy praise. Thy praise he also, who forbids thy use, conceals not from us, naming thee the tree of knowledge, knowledge both of good and evil, forbids us then to taste, but his forbidding commends thee more, while it infers the good of thee communicated and our want. For good unknown, sure it not hard, sure is not had, or had and yet unknown, is as not had at all. In plain, then, what forbids he but to know, forbids us good, forbids us to be wise. Such prohibitions bind not, but if death binds us with afterbands, what profits then our inward freedom? In the day we eat of this fair fruit, our doom is we shall die. How dies the serpent? He hath eaten and lives and knows and speaks and reasons and discerns, irrational till then. For us alone was death invented, or to us denied this intellectual food for beasts reserved? For beasts, it seems. Yet that one beast which first hath tasted envies not, but brings with joy the good befallen him, author unsuspect, friendly to man, far from deceit or guile. What fear I then? Rather, what know to fear under this ignorance of good and evil, of God or death, of law or penalty? Here grows the cure of all. This fruit divine, fair to the eye, inviting to the taste, of virtue to make wise, what hinders them to reach and feed at once both body and mind?
So saying, her rash hand in evil hour, forth reaching to the fruit, she plucked, she eat. Earth felt the wound, and nature from her seat, sighing through all her works, gave signs of woe, that all was lost. Back to the thicket slunk the guilty serpent, and well might, For Eve intent now wholly on her taste, naught else regarded, but such delight till then as seemed in fruit she never tasted, whether true or fancied so, through expectation high of knowledge, naught was Godhead from her thought. Greedily she engorged without restraint, and knew not eating death. Satiate at length, and heightened as with wine, jocund and boon, thus to herself she pleasingly began.
O sovereign, virtuous, precious of all trees in paradise, of operation blessed to sapiens, hitherto obscured and famed, and thy fair fruit let hang, as to no end created. But henceforth my early care, not without song each morning and due praise, shall tend thee, and fertile burden ease, of all thy full branches offered free to all. Till dieted by thee, I grow mature to knowledge, as the gods who all things know, though others envy what they cannot give. For had the gift been theirs, it had not here thus grown. Experience next to thee I owe best guide. Not following thee, I had remained in ignorance. Thou openest wisdom's way and givest access, though secret she retire. And I perhaps am secret. Heaven is high, high and remote to see, from thence distinct each thing on earth, and other care perhaps may have diverted from continual watch our great forbidder, safe from all his spies about him. But to Adam, in what sort shall I appear? Shall I to him make known as yet my change, and give him to partake full happiness with me, or rather not, but keep the odds of my knowledge in my power without co-partner? So, to add what wants in female sex, the more to draw his love and render me more equal, and perhaps a thing not undesirable, sometime superior or inferior, who is free? This may be well, but what if God have seen and death ensue? Then I shall be no more, and Adam wedded to another Eve shall live with her enjoying, I extinct, a death to think. Confirm then I resolve, Adam shall share with me in bliss or woe. So dear I love him, that with him all deaths I could endure, without him live no life.
So saying, from the tree her step she turned. But first low reverence done as to the power that dwelt within, whose presence had infused into the plant sciental sap, derived from nectar, drink of gods. Adam, the while, waiting desirous her return, had wove of choicest flowers a garland to adorn her dresses and her rural labor's crown, as reapers oft are wont their harvest queen. Great joy he promised to his thoughts, and new solace in her return, so long delayed. Yet oft his heart, divine of something ill, misgave him. He the faltering measure felt, and forth to meet her went, the way she took that morn when first they parted, by the tree of knowledge he must pass. There he her met, scarce from the tree returning, in her hand a bough of fairest fruit, that downy smiled, new gathered and ambrosial smell diffused. To him she hasted, in her face excuse came prologue, an apology to prompt, which, with bland words at will, she thus addressed.
Hast thou not wondered, Adam, at my stay? Thee I have missed, and thought it long, deprived thy presence, agony of love till now not felt, nor shall be twice, for nevermore mean I to try what rash untried I sought, the pain of absence from thy sight. But strange hath been the cause, and wonderful to hear. This tree is not as we are told, a tree of danger tasted, nor to evil unknown opening the way, but of divine effect to open eyes, and make them gods who taste, and have been tasted such, the serpent wise,
or not restrained as we, or not obeying, have eaten of the fruit, and is become not dead as we are threatened, but thenceforth endued with human voice and human sense, reasoning to admiration, and with me persuasively hath so prevailed that I have also tasted, and have also found the effects to correspond. Opener mine eyes, dim erst, dilated spirits, ampler heart, and growing up to Godhead, which for thee chiefly I sought, without thee can despise. For bliss, as thou hast part, to me is bliss, tedious, unshared with thee, and odious soon. Thou, therefore, also taste, that equal lot may enjoin us, equal joy, as equal love. Lest thou, not tasting different degree, disjoin us, and I then too late renounce deity for thee, when fate will not permit.
Thus Eve, with countenance blithe, her story told, but in her cheek distemper flushing glowed. On the other side, Adam, soon as he heard the fatal trespass done by Eve, amazed, astonished, astonied stood, and blank, while horror chill ran through his veins, and all his joints relaxed. From his slack hand the garland wreathed for Eve down dropped, and all the faded roses shed. Speechless he stood and pale, till thus at length, first to himself, he inward silence broke.
Oh, fairest of creation, last and best of all God's work, creature in whom excelled whatever can to sight or thought be formed, holy, divine, good, amiable, or sweet, how art thou lost? How on a sudden lost, defaced, deflowered, and now to death devote? Rather, how hast thou yielded to transgress the strict forbiddance, how to violate the sacred fruit forbidden? Some cursed fraud of enemy hath beguiled thee, yet unknown, and me with thee hath ruined, for with thee certain my resolution is to die. How can I live without thee? How forego thy sweet converse and love so dearly joined, to live again in these wild woods forlorn? Should God create another Eve and I another rib afford, yet loss of thee would never from my heart. No, no, I feel the link of nature draw me. Flesh of flesh, bone of my bone thou art, and from thy state mine never shall be parted. Bliss or woe.
So, having said, as one from sad dismay recomforted, and after thoughts disturbed, submitting to what seemed remediless, thus, in calm mood, his words to Eve he turned.
Bold deed thou hast presumed, adventurous Eve, and peril great provoked, who thus hath dared, had it been only coveting to I, that sacred fruit, sacred to abstinence, much more to taste it under ban to touch. But past who can recall or done undo? Not God omnipotent, nor fate, yet so perhaps thou shalt not die. Perhaps the fact is not so heinous now, foretasted fruit, profaned first by the serpent, by him first made common and unhallowed ere our taste, nor yet on him found deadly. He yet lives as thou saidst, and gains to live as man higher degree of life, inducement strong to us, as likely tasting to attain proportional ascent, which cannot be but to be gods or angels, demigods. Nor can I think that God, creator wise, though threatening, will in earnest so destroy us, his prime creatures, dignified so high, set over all his works, which in our fall, for us created, needs with us must fail, dependent made. So God shall uncreate, be frustrate, do, undo, and labor lose, not well conceived of God, who though his power creation could repeat, yet would be loath us to abolish, lest the adversary triumph and say, fickle their state whom God most favors, who can please him long? Me first he ruined, now mankind, whom will he next? Matter of scorn, not to be given the foe. However, I with thee have fixed my lot, certain to undergo like doom. If death consort with thee, death is to me as life. So forcible within my heart I feel the bond of nature draw me to my own in thee. For what thou art is mine. Our state cannot be severed. We are one, one flesh. To lose thee were to lose myself.
So Adam, and thus Eve to him replied,
O glorious trial of exceeding love, illustrious evidence, example high, engaging me to emulate, but short of thy passion, how shall I attain? Of whose gifts I owe to my son, and whatever you hear thee speak, one heart and soul of, whereof good proof this day affords, declaring things all, death and death, or on death, or dread, separatist, meaning to undergo with me one guilt, one crime, a fixing this fair fruit, whose virtue, for of good, still good proceeds, direct, or by occasion hath presented this happy trial of thy love, which else so imminently never had been known. Were it I thought death menaced would ensue, this my attempt, I would sustain alone the worst, and not persuade thee, rather die deserted than oblige thee with a fact pernicious to thy peace, chiefly assured remarkably so late of thy so true, so faithful love unequaled. But I feel far otherwise the event, not death, but life augmented, opened eyes, new hopes, new joys, taste so divine that what of sweet before hath touched my sense, flat seems to this and harsh. On my experience, Adam, freely taste, and fear of death deliver to the winds.
So saying, she embraced him, and for joy tenderly wept, much won that he his love had so ennobled, as of choice to incur divine displeasure for her sake, or death. In recompense for such compliance bad, such recompense best merits, from the bough she gave him of that fair enticing fruit with liberal hand. He scrupled not to eat against his better knowledge, not deceived, but fondly overcome with female charm. Earth trembled from her entrails, as again in pangs, and nature gave a second groan. Sky lured, and muttering thunder, some sad drops wept at completing of the mortal sin original, while Adam took no thought, eating his fill. Nor Eve to iterate her former trespass feared, the more to soothe him with her loved society. But now, as with new wine intoxicating both, they swim in mirth, and fancy that they feel divinity within them, breeding wings, wherewith to scorn the earth. But that false fruit far other operation first displayed. Carnal desire inflaming, he on Eve began to cast lascivious eyes. She him as wantonly repaid. In lust they burn. Till Adam thus gan Eve to dalliance move.
Eve, now I see thou art exact of taste and elegant, of sapience no small part, since to each meaning savor we apply, and palate call judicious. I the praise yield thee, so well this day thou hast purveyed. Much pleasure have we lost while we abstained from this delightful fruit, nor known till now true relish, tasting. If such pleasure be in things to us forbidden, it might be wished, for this one tree hath been forbidden 10. But come, so well refreshed, now let us play, as meat is, after such delicious fare. For never did thy beauty, since the day I saw thee first and wedded thee, adorned with all perfections, so inflame my sense with ardor to enjoy thee. Fairer now than ever, bounty of this virtuous tree.
So, said he, and forbore not glance or toy of the amorous intent, well understood of Eve, whose eye darted contagious fire. Her hand he seized, and to a shady bank, thick o'erhead with verdant roof embowered, he led her nothing loath. Flowers were the couch, pansies and violets, and asphodel and hyacinth, earth's freshest, softest lap. There they fill of love and love's disport, took largely of their mutual guilt the seal, the solace of their sin, till dewy sleep oppressed them, wearied with their amorous play. Soon as the force of that fallacious fruit, that with exhilarating vapor bland about their spirits had played, and inmost powers made air, was now exhaled, and grosser sleep, bred of unkindly fumes, with conscious dreams encumbered, now had left them. Up they rose as from unrest, and each the other viewing, soon found their eyes how opened, and their minds how darkened. Innocence, that as a veil had shadowed them from knowing ill, was gone. Just confidence, and native righteousness, and honor from about them, naked left to guilty shame. He covered, but his robe uncovered more. He rose the day-night strong Herculean Samson from the harlot lap of Philistine Delilah, and waked shorn of his strength. They, destitute and bare of all their virtue, silent and in face confounded, long they sat, as stricken mute, till Adam, though not less than Eve abashed, at length gave utterance to these words constrained.
Oh, Eve, in evil hour thou didst give ear to that false worm, of whomsoever taught to counterfeit man's voice, true in our fall, false in our promised rising. Since our eyes opened, we find indeed, and find we know both good and evil, good lost and evil got, bad fruit of knowledge, if this be to know, which leaves us naked thus, of honor void, of innocence, of faith, of purity, our wanted ornaments now soiled and stained, and in our faces evident the signs of foul concupiscence, whence evil store, even shame, the last of evils, of the first be sure then. How shall I behold the face henceforth of God or angel, erst with joy and rapture so oft beheld? Those heavenly shapes will dazzle now this earthly, with their blaze insufferably bright. Oh, might I here in solitude live savage, in some glade obscured, where highest woods impenetrable to sun or starlight spread their umbrage broad and brown as evening. Cover me, ye pines, ye cedars, with innumerable boughs, hide me, where I may never see them more. But let us now, as in bad plight, devise what best may for the present serve to hide the parts of each from other that seem most to shame obnoxious and unseemliest seen. some tree whose broad, smooth leaves together sewed and girded on our loins may cover round those middle parts, that this newcomer, shame, there sit not and reproach us as unclean.
Set the narrator.
Yeah, sorry.
So counseled he.
Hang on, I'm there. I got lost. Okay. So counseled he, and both together went into the thickest wood. There soon they choose the fig tree, not that kind for fruit renowned, but such as to this day to Indians known. In Malabar, our deacon spreads her arms, branching so broad and long, that in the ground the bended twigs take root, and daughters grow about the mother tree. A pillared shade, high overarched, and echoing walks between. There oft the Indian herdsman, shunning heat, shelters in cool, and tends his pasturing herds at loopholes cut through thickest shade. Those leaves they gathered, broad as Amazonian targe, and with what skill they had together sewed to gird their waist, vain covering as to hide their guilt and dreaded shame. Oh, how unlike to that first naked glory. Such of late Columbus found the American, so girt with feathered cincture, naked else and wild among the trees on isles and woody shores. Thus fenced, and as they thought their shame in part covered, but not at rest or ease of mind, they sat them down to weep. Nor only tears rained at their eyes, but high winds worse within began to rise, high passions, anger, hate, mistrust, suspicion, discord, and shook sore their inward state of mind, calm region once and full of peace, now tossed and turbulent, for understanding ruled not, and the will heard not her lore, both in subjection now to sensual appetite, who from beneath usurping over sovereign reason claimed superior sway. From thus distempered breast, Adam, estranged in look and altered style, speech intermitted, thus to Eve renewed.
Would thou hadst hearkened to my words, and stayed with me as I besought thee, when that strange desire of wandering this unhappy morn, I know not whence possessed thee. We had then remained still happy, not as now, despoiled of all our good, shamed, naked, miserable. Let none henceforth seek needless cause to approve the faith they owe, when earnestly they seek such proof, conclude, they then begin to fail.
To whom, soon moved with touch of blame, thus Eve.
What words have passed thy lips, Adam severe, imputest thou that to my default which who knows might as ill have happened, thou being by, or to thyself perhaps? Hadst thou been there, or hear the attempt, thou couldst not have discerned fraud in the serpent, speaking as he spake. No ground of enmity between us known, why he should mean me ill, or seek to harm. Was I to have never parted from thy side, as good have grown there, still a lifeless limb? Being as I am, why didst not thou, the head, command me absolutely not to go, going into such dangers, thou sayest? Too facile then, thou didst not much gainsay, nay, didst permit, approve, and fair dismiss. Hadst thou been firm and fixed in thy descent, neither had I transgressed, nor thou with me.
To whom, then first incensed, Adam replied,
Is this the love? Is this the recompense of mine to thee, ingrateful Eve? Expressed immutable when thou wert lost, not I, who might have lived and joyed immortal bliss, yet willingly chose rather death with thee. And am I now upbraided as the cause of thy transgressing? Not enough severe, it seems, in thy restraint. What could I more? I warned thee, I admonished thee, foretold the danger and the lurking enemy that lay in wait. Beyond this had been force, and force upon free will hath here no place. But confidence then bore thee on, secure either to meet no danger or to find matter of glorious trial. And perhaps I also erred in overmuch admiring what seemed in thee so perfect, that I thought no evil durst attempt thee. But I rue that error now, which is become my crime, and thou the accuser. Thus it shall befall him to him who to worth in women overtrusting lets her will rule. Restraint she will not brook, and left to herself, if evil thence ensue, she first his weak indulgence will accuse.
Thus they in mutual accusation spent the fruitless hours, but neither self-condemning, and in their vain contest appeared no end.
Wow.
We've heard this one before.
Yeah, we have. Not quite in those terms.
Wow. I'm reading, I've been reading a lot of social theory. I've been reading this guy, Emmanuel Wallerstein. He wrote The World Analysis
theory.
You're familiar with him. Yeah. But I listened to a talk that he gave right before he died. He said that I think this is just a few years ago. He died about a year and a half ago, yeah. And he said capitalism is over. The end of limitless growth. There's no such thing as growth anymore. He said, this sort of upset me. He says we're going to be in a chaotic period for at least 50 years. And it's going to be, he says in chaos, he says when you're in a stable system, it's very hard to change anything, because anything anyone says or does is going to revert to the status quo, the pattern that already exists. But when you're in a chaotic system, this is where he says those butterfly effects occur. So the slightest change in one area of the system can create a dramatic change in another area of the system. That butterfly effect can create a hurricane on the other side of the planet. So I think that there's something about this enmity between Adam and Eve, which we've seen at every dinner table and every breakfast table, where there's this tremendous tension. I remember in my own household, my father throwing a cup of hot coffee in my mother's face, calling her a bitch. And her response to that was, "You sexist pig." I laugh about it now. It wasn't very funny then. But I think this tension is has a long history, and I suspect it's not over yet. If we look at Black Lives Matter, the feminist movement, the intellectual dark web, all these competing theories and conflict of visions, it just seems to me we're in this very volatile situation. And no doubt, actually, I think the beginning of capitalism starts with the British Civil War, which is, you know, Milton's era. So the big conflicts between church and state had already, they weren't over, but they had been previous to Milton, but he was really dealing with the nation state and the whole idea of debt and creditors and the relationship and the whole idea of sovereignty. What was it to be the king if the king was the largest debtor. This, of course, is what the Federal Reserve Bank decides with the interest rates of, are we going to make the U.S. the biggest debtor to keep the world economy moving? And if that's the case, then, you know, the people, the domestic politics is going to be spilling over into the streets. So I think this is the big dilemma, which started with at the end of the medieval, the Renaissance, the whole idea of free markets and free trade, and what's going on in England during Milton's age, and we're still in it. But I think there was a period of stability, because during the age of imperialism, as Wallerstein says, you know, there were certain players who were pretty good at it. Spain flopped, but Britain did pretty good. But then, you know, in 1873, he says Britain started to decline, and the America, United States of America, started to take on that hegemonic role. Certainly after the Second World War, there was that 20-year period of enormous growth. But I think that now that that's over, we're in free fall. And I think it was wasn't it Nixon who withdrew the gold standard?
Yeah.
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 Evidently, De Gaulle had a boat. He sent it to the United States, and he wanted the gold that the United States owed. And Nixon said, fuck you. We're going to drop the gold standard. And I think that was the beginning of the free fall. But so far, everyone's been buying American bonds and investing in American bonds because they stay stable. But there's this discrepancy between bonds and dollars. And poor people trade with dollars. The rich, of course, have bonds. So it's a tremendous crisis. And
but you've been talking about the information, that Milton as being this information story about information. And in some ways, it's the information age that's replacing the capitalist age, because we always, you know, I think of Paul Kennedy's talks about the fact that information can be unlimitedly created, and therefore the capitalist attempt to tie information down into the old model, it's working to some extent, but it's ultimately it's going to fail, because information can't be managed that way. And eventually it will break out of the bonds of the capitalism. And so we're in this process of change to something else, right? And I think it's really interesting, because you started your intervention by talking about Adam and Eve and the masculine and the feminine. At the same time now, we've got the whole trans issue emerging on the world stage. And the trans changes up the male-female dichotomy and creates new spaces in that spectrum. So instead of being stuck with two, we now have other choices that are beginning to break, which is also part of this information shift, I think. Digging off what you said, but
I think there were some people who called gay people a third sex, and now I and what all that means, the difference between gender and sex and culture, the cultural overlay, it's extremely ambiguous, since there's so wide variation in everyone we know between the so-called masculine and so-called feminine. But I think these are I agree. I think there's these kinds of tensions, and being able to hold the tension of the field of all possibility. If you don't have a center, a strong center, as I spoke about in the Life Divine, we're in real trouble, because you go out there with I'm just gonna relax into the field of all possibilities, you're gonna get hit by a bus. There's something's gonna come down and hit you on the head, or someone's gonna steal all your money. So I think there's there has to be some sort of center where you can say, this is what I'm in alignment with, this is what I value, this is what I aspire to, this is my desired outcome. And then you can open yourself to the field of all possibility, and you can become an attractor along with within the relational field for something that might be of use, especially in a chaotic situation. And I think that's what, as a member of that that movement, the LGBTQ movement, which is still ongoing, which has triumphed actually in a conservative court to decide on the favor of it. That is just an absolute miracle that that happened. But it did happen, but it didn't come from anywhere or nowhere. It came from actual people who were embodied and were vibrating with one another. And they said, well, this is what we want. We don't know how it's going to happen, but it's what we want. And it takes generations, I think, for that kind of change to happen. And I think that's when we're in the middle of the civilization collapse with the capitalism. Everything's up in the air right now. And that's why I think we're all sort of creating attractors for one another in this space, hopefully by studying great literature and using our voices and working with our traumas and paying attention to the binds and the double binds that are in our culture. We hopefully can find some kind of stability, enough stability, so that we can, you know, figure out, well, what's the next step that we need to take? What is actionable in these kind of circumstances? So I think it's great that we're training, we're sort of training our imaginations here to sort of reimagine male, female, masculine, feminine. I just saw a beautiful trans man online on a YouTube channel. That's just amazing. When I was growing up, gay people couldn't contact one another. We had to do it through a straight press. Now there are channels where gays, trans, you know, lesbians, they can all create their own networks and they can say whatever the fuck they want. It's like, and they don't have to worry as we did growing up with retaliation. There is certainly retaliation. There was, but now that the Supreme Court has decided, we can get married, we can join the army if we want, we can become president of the United States, we can run for office, we don't have to worry about losing a housing or job. And we were the only group that was legally discriminated against. That is so amazing to me. But that's over now. So what happens next? I'm not sure. I think that the whole categories that I was raised in, with gay and straight and bisexual and the oppositional stances that happened, it's all sort of doesn't matter anymore. And that's a feeling about, strangely enough, I don't have to organize my behavior in an oppositional stance anymore.
Kind of breaking up, Johnny, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm rambling a little bit.
Your oppositional, you don't organize yourself in an oppositional stance. That's the last
one. Yeah, and then what happens when you don't have to do that anymore? Certainly, I think we're looking at Black Lives Matter, and that's an ongoing historical grievance that runs very, very deep in us. And how are we going to unravel that knot? And I think that's what's happened. I think we're all of these grievances and hungry ghosts and the generations that were not able to find any fulfillment, but who made the United States of America such an incredibly rich for some, and most people are very, very poor. I think this is an unbelievable challenge for us. And I don't have any answers. And I wouldn't trust anyone who said that they did. But I think that we're all studying very hard and creating these study groups and tapping into the beauty of beautiful language, such as Milton. I think these are very good signs. We should just do more of it and do it even better. I think that's a new way of finding satisfaction in a world where unlimited growth is over. Because there is growth, but it's a different kind of growth. It's a kind of interior development that I think we could all sponsor one another. That could give us a deep satisfaction, which, you know, running after the Yankee dollar isn't going to do anyway. It isn't going to work anymore, since it's going to rapidly become useless. Anyway, forgive me for the rant, but that's what happens to me after I've been drinking coffee and reading Milton.
I can't wait to find out what happens in book 10. Never mind the rest of it.
we're getting near the end of this epic. I thought it was interesting, John, how you jumped immediately to our present context and kind of like, you know, what the power relations are and what some of those dynamics are, because they're very complex. And here we have these kind of vertical relations between the human realm and the transcendental, or the divine, and then the infernal. But then we have the horizontal relations between Adam and Eve and how they're now going to negotiate their different identities. This is all framed in a binary male-female sort of scenario, but it's not so different psychologically, like the kinds of quarrels and the kinds of bickering and the kinds of sort of inability to, like the lost ability to have to experience solidarity. And yet at the same time, this kind of self-interested relationship that they maintain, I think those things are still true, right? Like part of what we learn from about Eve here, and this should not be like imparted upon all women, this is like a human, is that she gains a certain power, she gains a certain upper hand in a way, because now she has this knowledge and she has access to the fruit. And the question is whether or not to share it with Adam. And she does this little calculus in her head. Like, well, if I don't share it with him, I may die alone and he'll just get another Eve and, you know, continue to live in paradise. If I do share it with him, then I'll have somebody that I love. So she authentically loves him. I won't be alone. They'll stay with me, even though we may die together, even though I'm going to drag him down with me in a sense. And I think that those kinds of calculations and that way that people sort of try to negotiate what their relation is going to be like in the face of this kind of catastrophic influx is really, I think, still true, still illuminative. And then Adam has a similar kind of decision to make. Like, is he going to stick with Eve? He doesn't have to, right? But he's seduced, not necessarily by her, but by his own desire for her, and partakes of the fruit, and then they screw. Like then they, you know, then like they're like
they fornicate.
Yeah, they that was all. And it sounds like a great night, you know. And then there's the hangover. There's a hangover.
That was kind of a nice night, but the leftovers aren't that great.
Right. Was it worth it? Was it worth it?
And they want to get put on clothes. He tosses her a loincloth or some leaves and says, cover up, please. You know. Yeah.
So, I mean, the question I kind of have is, all right, this is now a mythopoetic sort of scenario. But it's an object lesson. Like there's some, like we're meant, I think, to translate this into our own circumstances. And I'm curious, I don't have an answer to this. I'm curious what you all think. What is our fruit? What is our forbidden fruit? What is it that we, could taste and could know something that we don't know, and that, you know, may initiate us into another level of knowing or being that kind of would parallel this transgression that Adam and Eve make, which is part of their historical coming out of, you know, taking their journey into consciousness, really, into higher consciousness and into evolutionary growth. But it has to start from a recognition of their fallenness and their forlorn state. Just put that out there. I don't know. It's something I'm noodling right now. And I mean, some people see this, like Terence McKenna would see this as a kind of drug, anti-drug PSA, like the first kind of like, you know, war on drugs message, thou shall not, you know, eat of this fruit. And, you know, the experience has definite, like, real parallels. You know, one could take us any number of different kinds of substances and have ecstatic experiences and feel like one knows something that one didn't know before, and in some real way be initiated into a new domain of knowing. And yet there's also this fall from that, where because it's dependent on an exogenously introduced substance, one hasn't developed the whole architecture, the whole cognitive and psychological and emotional architecture to really to sustain those kinds of states or to sustain that kind of knowing. Nonetheless, the fruit, the mushroom, the molecule initiates, you know, into that kind of gnosis. So I wonder if that is that an equivalent in our day? Is, say, psychedelics an equivalent? Or is lucid dreaming an equivalent? Or, you know, what other kind of modes of consciousness can we tap into that, like, that alter the power relations and the dynamic between the horizontal and the vertical, and what information is to be, you know, received from those kinds of encounters and experiences?
Like something like space exploration a la Musk.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The difference between outer space and inner space, I think, is going to be front and center in this brave new world that's being shaped through our observations and our participations. I definitely have a bias for the subtle rather than the virtual. I think if the virtual were to disappear, many of us would be just fine. But the virtual reality, since it's here to stay, it's not going anywhere. It's only going to take over more and more and more of our imaginal lives. But can we use it in a way that we can protect the subtle from the intrusion of the VR? And maybe there can be new alliances that can form different kinds of subtle through participation being augmented with the virtual reality. But I don't think if we hope to survive, we should expect the virtual to replace the subtle. I think that would be enormous folly. And I think that's where Elon Musk, I think, is out of his mind, you know, thinking we can just take the fragmented worldview that we already have, and that's polluted this environment, you know, this Garden of Eden that we've been given, and we can just go off to Mars or wherever and plant a flag, you know, and that anything would be remotely different. But I've actually heard physicists talk about colonizing all of these planets in the next 1,000 years. I just think it's incredible folly, but I also think it's misdirected. The interior and the exterior, and the internal and the external, these are very subtle differences that, and you can't just say, we're gonna drop all of that and just focus on this. Just like we can't just focus on the interior, we have to deal with the exterior and the external. But I think this is where integral theory is very useful, and I hope more people would be more familiar with it. Because we're creating these very lopsided and out of balance oppositional stances, these binaries, and I feel like it's not necessary. But I do believe that I have this problem with Bonnie Roy's stuff, that she was just wanting to dissolve the ego and drop underneath the story. And just explore the energy and just relax. Well, yeah, that's part of it, but that doesn't mean you can do without stories, because stories and new stories will emerge, no doubt. And I think this is where, you know, the study of literature is front and center in so many of our attentions, because this is where we experiment with narrative and meta-narrative. And the idea that, you know, we can just drop meta-narratives, I think, is absurd. You can't organize groups of people without a meta-narrative. I don't think you should be stuck in any meta-narrative, but to just dismiss the whole narrative. Because narratives are communication devices. We tell stories in order to communicate, and people want to hear what your story is.
And if to think about our futures, right? I mean, that's how we get to the future, is through story.
Exactly. And definitely, I agree, we can traumatize ourselves with the, you know, terrible stories that we can tell one another. But I do think there's a facility that you can, as I tried to sort of demonstrate to my own experience of working with these, with my own very fragile sort of understandings in this very fragile environment socially that we're in, with all these riots going on, helicopters overhead, the drones, you know, looking for people, the seeing the glass on the streets, you know, the storefronts that are had been broken into. This stuff is real, you know, I'm trying to find my own way through all this, but I realize in many ways it's not about me, and it's not about any of us as individuals, but it's about these, you know, forces that are working through us. And the more mindful we are of the impacts and our ability to relax, but not just to relax so we can escape, but to relax so that we can better facilitate our desired outcomes in the circumstances we find ourselves in, and find allies as well. I think it's going to be really, really crucial. And I think we're doing it. We're doing the best that we can. It's small, what we're doing, but I think it's the butterfly effects can accumulate. If all the butterflies would get together and flap their wings in unison, in harmony, we might have a huge, huge impact.
So I'm here, I'm just standing up, and I'm not decent below the waist, so.
Shame. Cover yourself up.
So we're on 10, we have 10 coming up?
I woke up this morning to thunder and rain. It sort of, the whole building was thrumming with the rain. So it seemed appropriate for this chapter.
Yeah, I love that.
Oh, I love it.
Well, you know, I guess we'll continue on to book 10 next time.
Yeah,
I do have a question to follow up with on something you were saying, John. Because there's a lot of energy in oppositional organizing, like oppositional orienting and feeling, and to have somebody or something or some to be against is really motivating and really galvanizing, and also can cohere community. But it seems that if that begins to dissolve, then one could be left in a state of kind of directionlessness or purposelessness or a feeling of depression or nothingness, because now what gets you out of bed in the morning?
Right.
So I think part of what we're also looking for, and in a way, this is kind of what I think we can loop this back to Paradise Lost, but what's a larger story that can be motivating, that's trans-oppositional or post-oppositional, and that also is more adequate to the complexity of the individuals and the situation that, you know, that has to be held in that story. And I think that's part of like what we kind of need to coalesce, cohere, to get beyond the fractiousness of the moment. But at the same time, it has to respect the oppositional energy, because a nice meta narrative might not get you out of oppression, right? It might not change the structure of policing. It might not just have enough, like, if people weren't out there causing havoc, maybe the rest of the country wouldn't be listening. And now we're listening. You know, now things are actually changing at a policy level. Politicians are, you know, getting in line. And a lot of folks, I mean, there's an ideological and a kind of violent aspect to this? Like when you want, you know, try to force people to agree with you or to say the slogan or, and, you know, at the same time, there's like an urgency of life or death. So it's understandable. But part of what I think this kind of reading is teaching us, at least what I'm learning from it or beginning to learn from it, is how we could look at, like, how we could frame a meta-narrative that is trans-oppositional, is evolutionary, you know, is complex, and is compelling, right? So it vibrates, you know, it resonates. It's not just a static framework. It's not just a kind of big story, but it gets you out of your seat. Because we need to be mobilized, and we need a big enough story, you know, that and an intimate enough, something that speaks, can speak to our depths at the same time that it speaks to the breadth and the breadth of, you know, our common humanity. So, I love what we're doing, and, I look forward to continuing and to, completing this book and probably I'd like, this is just like a first pass too. So I think there's something in me that wants to dive back in now that having the overview, like, you know, that allowing, like a deeper, you know, engagement, and I don't know. I think that's all I want to say for now, but, I do think we're getting better, and I like that the, you know, our efforts are producing fruit.
I do too. Just one more thing, and then I'll shut up. But I think to change the world, even as we are reinterpreting that world, it's very, very tricky because we don't have a clear foundation upon which we can stand and then say, let's make changes. Because we have to constantly reinterpret what's going on around us so that any desired outcome that we propose to one another will have a provisional nature to it. But I'm very reluctant, and this is my big spiel here, is let's just discard desired outcomes and be realists, because then we're really going to sink fast, because there has to be enough of us who will, what do we really want? Not what do we think we can get, but what do we really want? And that's where I think the gay movement triumphed, because we stuck with our desired outcome. We want to be free of this stigma. Now, where are we liberated yet? No. But I think that all of these liberation movements have that in common, that, and that may be very tricky. But I'm not saying let's get rid of the realist either. I'm just saying we have to blend the dreamer, the realist, with the critic. But right now, I think there's an addiction to endless critique that's going nowhere.
And certainty. So this is the other thing. I think we need to move away from stances that are certain. Right. Paradox is, you know, paradox requires you to deal with the uncertainties. You know, this thing that you're talking about of changing the world while you're reinterpreting is a paradox, right? And inside that paradox, there are no certainties, but that's the way, the nature of the world that we live in today anyway, right? It's interesting to think about that in terms of Milton, because in a way he was describing a paradox. I mean, at all levels, the thing between God and Satan, the thing between Adam and Eve, all these different levels, the thing between paradise, the tree of good and evil, and all of these are paradoxes recast in different ways. So I think that's interesting. And also it's grand narrative. We live in a culture which spent the last sort of 50 years rejecting grand narrative and focusing down on micro kind of understandings of the world, and we're in an era where people need to where we need a kind of broader vision of things again. And Milton takes us there. So I do think it's an important exercise to undertake. The grand narratives today won't look like the grand narratives of the past, though. So that's part of what's the struggle, is to figure out what is the grand narrative if it doesn't look like what they used to be, right?
Right. No matter how provisional that grand narrative is, it could create all kinds of opportunities. And then that can be discarded and another grand narrative can emerge. But I think more important than that, as Marco mentioned about the horizontal, can we move from discipline to discipline to discipline? And as we make that move, those overlaps between discipline, I'm borrowing from Bateson here, or from Nora Bateson, that transcontextual kind of orientation. So we don't have to get locked into those kind of turf wars between disciplines, get trapped in the ivory tower of academia. So I think it's great. You can be a scientist, you can be a poet, you can be a dancer, you can be a yogi. You can move from all of these different disciplines. And that, I think, those horizontal moves are where we learn how to translate adequately or more adequately, rather than get trapped in, these hierarchical grids. And I think that's what we're doing. We move from all different kinds of study groups, with widely different kinds of areas of expertise. So, and how we read together and reinterpret together, it's kind of delicious in a way. It's so bewildering to me sometimes, but then sometimes it sort of takes on a kind of order that I could never have predicted.
I got fruit.
Yes, yes.
It's delicious.
Yummy, yummy, yummy. I got love in my tummy. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. All right.
Looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, book 10 in 2 weeks, I believe.
Yeah. And I'll see you later today, Marco.
Indeed. All right.
Enjoy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.